Quill, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on September 17th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University and McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland, Francis King Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
So Frank, this week we welcome Aaron Kesselheim. Dr. Kesselheim is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a faculty member in the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and Pharmacoeconomics in the Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Aaron is an extremely well-respected researcher across multiple disciplines and a prodigious scholar. If you haven't come across something that he's written in either the serious literature or in an influential magazine, I just don't think you've been doing any reading. Special welcome, Aaron.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So we're going to confront a few knotty problems in Aaron's space, particularly FDA drug issues, drug pricing, and so on. But just a couple of news bites that caught my attention and Frank's attention this week, and see what you think of those. I'm going to take you all the way back to 2012. It seems a long time ago, when we had the Institute of Medicine report on health IT and patient safety, building safer systems for better care. And it was the first time that I remember seeing a serious treatment of so-called gag clauses in HIT, particularly EMR, supply contracts. And there's a quote in that 2012 report: as long as vendors may restrict the release of information about safety issues through confidentiality clauses, intellectual property protections, and hold harmless clauses, the healthcare community will be limited in its understanding of how health IT affects patient safety. Now, I have to admit, I thought that issue had pretty much been put to bed, because I recalled how the Electronic Health Records Association, which is, you know, obviously a strong industry group, it's organized by HIMSS, they actually have a code of conduct which they put out not long after that report. Quote, "We recognize the value of our customers' participation in discussions about patient safety. We will not contractually limit our customers from discussing patient safety issues in appropriate venues. In applying this policy, we will maintain fair and reasonable intellectual property protections." So I thought it was a non-issue. Then this week, Politico released a really interesting investigation that demonstrated pretty clearly that gag clauses are still the norm. And they actually managed to get hold of some of the EMR contracts with these clauses in there. Now, they seem to be justified as primarily protecting IP, but I think there's a really good argument that they're chilling safety researchers. The get-out-of-jail clause that they built into the code of conduct was, well, we will not limit our customers from discussing patient safety issues in appropriate venues. And apparently, they have a very restrictive view of what an appropriate venue is. So the Politico sort of story sort of ended with a, I got a sense of, well, what can you do about this? Who could do something about these clauses? And to me, it is fairly clear. I don't see why ONC shouldn't ban these as part of the meaningful use certification requirements. But then, taking a step backwards, I also thought that this whole sort of pantomime is yet another consequence of the FDA using this incredibly regulation-light approach to most HIT.
I think that's a terrific commentary on that, Nick, and I do think it's a huge problem. I mean, I just remember going through some of these issues a few years ago, and yeah, like you, and it's funny because I have another topic that I want to bring up today that I think is similarly with the sort of drug shortages issue. I thought it was like big in the news a few years ago, but then it comes back in various ways, and it was very distressing to see this one come back. But I would love to look into further the degree to which the statutory language in high tech would enable, say, that type of action by ONC, because I do think it's a really would be a good initiative. My data point this week, or one of two, was along the lines of an attack on evidence in health policy making. At least that's the way it was framed by a researcher from CBPP, also in Politico. I guess this is our Politico week. noting that the House Appropriations Committee was seeking to rescind about $7 billion from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. Also, the Senate Appropriations Committee is advocating a 35% cut to the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. And it's just very troubling to see it because, you know, as we'll see from Aaron's research later on in the podcast today and from so much of the research we've discussed this year, there's just amazing savings that we can get out of really good health services research. And it looks like it's under attack that, ironically, CMMI is estimated to offer proposals and initiatives that will reduce federal healthcare spending by $38 billion. And it's only projected to be spending $11 billion between 2016 and 2025. So just very sad to see this effort. And let's hope that there's a little bit more respect paid to the role of research and its importance as the budget cycle goes forward.
Yeah, I agree, Frank. I mean, I think it's really kind of short. It's, you know, short-term thinking here. A little bit of spending right now in helping, you know, look into these issues and generate that research could lead to a lot more savings down the road when some of these projects come to fruition. So it's unfortunately a consequence of pressures in Congress to, penny pinch, in the short term. At the expense of thinking broader.
And what I find very odd about it, just to pitch, is that the CBO is all in favor of CMMI. I mean, and I know that when the Affordable Care Act was scored, there was a lot of uncertainty, and I think that the CBO refused to score savings from projected cost cuts or thanks to delivery system innovations like the Accountable Care Organizations, which we're also going to talk about this week. It seems as though now they're on board. They realize that this is going to be a very important source of savings, and yet still there's this push. And so I really have to look into how this, especially the push for fair value accounting and some of the other scoring accounting mechanisms in the budgeting process and the legislative process are affecting health policy, because it seems as though it only works in one direction, and that's not fair.
So talking about the Affordable Care Act, pop quiz, what did Section 3025 introduce? Tick, tick, tick. Anyone? No one? Okay, I'll tell you. It was the Hospital Readmissions Reduction Program, if you remember, which leads to significant Medicare reimbursement reductions for underperforming hospitals. There's been a lot of grumbling from the hospital industry about this, and the JAMA, internal medicine study that was published this week, probably gives them something of a leg to stand on and confirmed what many have argued. Quote, patient characteristics not included in Medicare's current risk adjustment methods explained much of the difference in readmission risk between patients admitted to hospitals with higher versus lower readmission rates, and that led to the conclusion that hospitals with high readmission rates may be penalized to a large extent based on the patients they serve. On the other hand, there is a bit of a sense now that that program actually does seem to be having some positive results and is leading to more outreach by hospitals into the community, building relationships with community health workers and so on. So I wonder if this is a rather blunt object that Medicare is using to hammer the health industry, but maybe it's a blunt instrument that's actually working reasonably well if you look at the big picture. Though I suppose that's not going to be a picture that the hospitals that are getting nailed with high penalties are really going to take a sanguine view of.
Yeah, I also think that, you know, when you look at the big picture of the Affordable Care Act rollout, especially with respect to the reductions in the DSH, the DSH payments, ostensibly made up for by the expansion of Medicaid, but now we have all these non-expansion states. So I'm very worried about sort of the cumulative impact of, say, these types of reductions, say, for failing to meet certain meaningful use stages, the loss of the projected Medicaid expansion. I think we're going to see some hospitals in some real trouble. And also, of course, we talked about Rick Scott's hospital tax a few episodes ago. So I just think overall this really worries me. On a more positive note, we do see, this was something that Nick tweeted this week, and I thought was quite interesting, a study that said that the accountable care organizations were indeed saving money. Now, of course, Physicians for a National Healthcare Program, I think, poo-pooed this study, said it was not that compelling, but I just wanted to make a note of it, and I'll also be connecting it, linking to it on the show page after our program. All right, and so I guess at this point we might just begin our interview with you, Aaron. And it's really exciting to have you on. And we have a number of topics in the realm of drug policy, FDA policy, et cetera. I was wondering, given how involved you've been in this policy space, if you might be able to give us and the listeners your sense of sort of the 10,000-foot view on what's going on, what are the chief initiatives we should be watching, and your insights on them.
Sure, my pleasure. I mean, I think it's a pretty interesting and exciting time with regard to drug and device policy. I think there are a lot of issues right now that are pivotal and can, you know, depending on how they come out, can lead to substantial changes in the way that we regulate drugs and devices. I think one of the major issues right now is the challenge, the ongoing challenges to the FDA's regime for regulating promotion of drugs, particularly the rules around when drug companies can and cannot promote the unapproved off-label uses of their products. I think that's one major issue. We saw a challenge earlier this year regarding off-label promotion of a prescription fish oil product that the FDA ended up losing on, and then this week brought another a second challenge in this space regarding a topical anesthetic product used in surgery, and so I think that this is a really concerning area of intersections between FDA law and First Amendment law. Another major initiative to keep an eye on is this 21st Century Cures Act, which passed the House of Representatives this summer, and a Senate version of it is now being built. And so it'll be interesting to see what the Senate comes up with. I think that they're expected to launch their version of the bill next month, and we'll see how much it aligns with what was passed in the House of Representatives version earlier this summer. I think that's another major issue. And then a third major issue that a lot of people are starting to talk more and more about are drug costs, predominantly brand name drug costs, and what we're going to do about some of these, ultra high expensive drugs. But also, there's also some chatter about generic drug costs, and in general, generic drugs are very inexpensive and a really good deal. But there are certain generic drugs that have skyrocketed in cost in the last couple years, and people are asking the question, well, why is this happening? So I think that those are, to me at least, three of the major areas that we've heard of. And then, just on a more functional level, we're talking this week in health law. It would be remiss of me not to note that this week also Obama announced that he was going to nominate Robert Califf for the next FDA commissioner position. So that's another up-to-the-minute update for your listeners.
Oh, that's just fantastic, Aaron. Thanks. And out of that plethora of topics, I was wondering if we could start with the generic drug pricing issue, because this was something that I found kind of mystifying. I mean, we've all been told that the magic of the market is supposed to deal with sort of post-patent drug competition. And I'm wondering if you're finding that there are forms of natural monopolization, collusion, just sort of implicit agreements among companies not to enter one another's space. I know that that's been alleged sometimes in the cable and telecom industry, that companies just don't go in and compete when they know that there's a dominant player in one market. Do you have insights on that in terms of what's causing it and what might solve that problem?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that everybody just kind of assumes that generic drugs are inexpensive, but the reason that generic drugs are inexpensive is because there's vibrant competition, or at least supposed to be vibrant competition in the generic drug marketplace. But what we're seeing is that for certain older drugs, enough manufacturers are dropping out so that where a product used to be, manufactured by 8 or 10 manufacturers, now it's being manufactured by more like 2 or 3. And when you're seeing that kind of consolidation, then the remaining manufacturers are able to raise their prices. You're also seeing consolidations in the market, in the generic marketplace. Teva recently bought the generic branch of Allergan, and now controls something like 20% of the international generic drug sales. So you're seeing some consolidation. You're also seeing certain manufacturers just taking advantage of increases of market consolidation that they hadn't before. And then I think that there is the possibility that there's collusion and other anti-competitive practices that we would need the Federal Trade Commission to take a look at. And I think that one of the interesting things about the generic drug marketplace is that you'd expect those sorts of issues to be fixed because, not patent protected products, you can get other manufacturers to enter. But the problem is that there's such a backlog right now of applications at the FDA for approval of generic drugs that it can take, 2 or 3 years for a manufacturers to recognize that there is, an opportunity in a certain market and try to enter it until they enter it, such that there's this delay that can afford to the benefit of the monopolists and, unfortunately lead to high prices for patients for much longer than it should be.
Yeah, we know, don't we, that the overall, the time frame for drug approvals has come down quite incredibly over the last few years. Is there a sense that maybe FDA could lighten the load still further on generics? Do they need as much scrutiny as they're getting at the moment?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think that in the brand name space, the FDA is the fastest regulator in the world, and in fact, the approval times for brand name drugs are the fastest they've ever been. Unfortunately, the generic branches at the FDA have atrophied, a little bit, and have not had the level of investment that has happened for the parts of the FDA that evaluate new brand name drugs. The 2012 FDASIA bill was supposed to help rectify that by creating generic drug user fees. So, replicating what happened in the brand name space and requiring generic manufacturers to, provide a little bit of funding to the FDA that could enhance their capacity. And I think that, so far at least, it's just, still too early for those things to start having a major impact on generic drug approval times. But I think that that's the goal that this new influx of user fees is supposed to encourage.
So let's move on to one of the other issues you raised in your introduction, Aaron, or let's go a little sideways from it. You talked about the recent issues, particularly regarding speech protection, that have come into the FDA regulatory space. But you had a piece in The Atlantic very recently it's entitled The FDA versus the Shill, talking about celebrity endorsements about about various drugs. And as I read the piece, I remembered that in 2014, the FDA had introduced a guidance for industry on social media advertising, marketing, specifically those with character space limitations. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the FDA versus the Shill piece and what you thought the issue was there, and exactly when does a sponsored read actually become advertising? I would have thought almost always.
Right. I mean, that was a fun piece. And it was a piece that was brought to my attention by my wife's Us Weekly newsfeed on her iPhone. And you know, I think it's a fascinating story. But basically, what happened was that Kim Kardashian posted a tweet and an Instagram photo of herself with a bottle of Diclegis, which is a brand name anti-nausea pill for used to treat nausea during during pregnancy, and provided an endorsement of it, indicating that she was doing this, quote, in partnership with the manufacturer. Well, it turns out that she's neither, you know, it isn't a you know, a egalitarian move here on Kardashian's part, but rather, as you might expect, she's being paid as a spokesman for this manufacturer of this product, for this morning sickness pill. And so because she's being paid and she was endorsing the use of the pill, that, you know, that makes this tweet and Instagram photo an advertisement. And the FDA was concerned because the advertisement only described the benefits of the products and didn't describe any of the substantial risks of it. And, you know, provided a link, but the FDA, you know, that link wasn't enough. You know, the FDA assuming quite correctly that, you know, a lot of Kardashian's 42 million followers are not going to go ahead and click on whatever it is she posted, but are just going to read it and view her as a, you know, as a some sort of opinion leader, and, you know, potentially, you know, look into using this product without having been fully informed about what some of the risks of it are. And so Kardashian had to post a corrective ad a few weeks later, although, you know, obviously separated from the original tweet, who knows what kind of impact a corrective ad might have had. But, you know, I think in this Atlantic piece, my co-author and I put this this bit of testimonial advertising in its historical context. And in fact, you know, a hundred years ago, the marketing of drugs was largely testimony driven. You know, and we've had celebrities through the decades who've been involved in giving and testimonials around prescription drugs. And it's, you know, it's a really tough thing for the FDA to regulate. And I think that if some of these First Amendment arguments about manufacturers being able to say whatever they want to about their medication, as long as it isn't false or outright fraudulent, then I think that these sorts of testimonials will only grow in their you know, frequency and in the types of claims that they're the egregiousness of the types of claims that they're making. So I think is a cause for concern, especially because, you know, a lot of these drugs are potentially very dangerous, and, you know, it's hard to fully express the risks and benefits of them in 140 characters.
And that raises a really interesting issue in terms of the FDA's regulation of social media in general, right? Because I remember trying to read through some of the guidance documents and other documents in this area, and, you know, I compare it also to, like, the FTC's .com disclosures, you know, where in a tweet, like, how much can you really disclose in the tweet? Are there ways, maybe there should be just a practice of having a URL in the tweet that might be, like, the disclosure URL or something like that? But I think it will take a lot of creativity in these areas to really wrestle with this. Another issue that I think is really critical is, like, user-generated content. Like, clearly, websites that I think that the industry is really raring to get websites up on Facebook or Twitter, create communities of users talking about the drug themselves. And you do wonder, you know, if there's editing of comments or shaping of the dialogue in a certain way, if that should be revealed or should be required to be revealed, because I think that's a way in which a lot of discourse is shaped nowadays, is you have big sites where people edit comments very selectively. So do you think there's a room for enforcement action there, Aaron, or future work? Or do you think that essentially the industry is really in a bit of a holding pattern and it's only sort of outliers that are doing things like the Kardashian Instagram intervention?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, everybody's moving very slowly. Both the FDA is moving slowly in terms of, you know, setting out definitive guidances in the social media space. And I think that the FDA is justified in doing that, you know, A, because the space is evolving so rapidly, and B, because the last two times they've, you know, opened up media to pharmaceutical promotion in the 1980s with print media, and in the 1990s with television media, there's been subsequent to that major explosions in billions and billions of dollars that are going into, you know, investing in direct-to-consumer advertising in both of those contexts. So, you know, you can only imagine that once you let the genie out of the bottle, it's tough to stick him back in. And you know, and for their part, the industry, which has had somewhat of a black eye over the last decade with regard to numerous, you know, illegal and you know, blatantly improper advertising to physicians and patients. You know, you can imagine that given the you know, the poor track record of their of pharmaceutical marketing over the past decade, that the industry is also, you know, probably moving slowly, not wanting to you know, go whole hog in both investing time and you know, and potentially you know, any kind of you know, trying to, you know, you know, further rapprochement by getting involved in this area. So I think that that's why you're seeing not a lot of movement in this space, because both the, you know, FDA and the industry are sort of circling each other, trying to figure out, well, what, you know, what are we supposed to do, and what are we supposed to do? And at the meantime, you know, the communication media itself is just evolving rapidly. And the examples that you were giving about how, you know, people can generate content or can edit other people's content, I mean, all that stuff is you know, really, it's really hard to figure how you would, you know, regulate that with any kind of effectiveness.
I agree. I think it is going to be a very difficult area to be working in. And I think that ideally there's going to be a lot more scholarly input, because particularly, you know, my sense of online lives, I've got a review of two books on internet comments coming out in the Chronicle of Higher Education in a couple of weeks. And the more I study that topic, the more suspicious I get. But doing a transition now, one thing I'd love to ask you, Aaron, is a double-sided question. So please run in either direction with this, or both directions, which is, I've been following the rollout by Gilead of Harvoni and Sovaldi for hepatitis C, and the huge pricing of that drug, I guess roughly $100,000 a year for the pills, and the varying responses of both governments and of insurers to either delay their insureds getting the drug, or, you know, facing very difficult decisions. So that I would love for you to address, if you could, about what might be future solutions to this, or other ways of dealing with the problem of some super expensive but very, very effective drugs. Secondly, I think you mentioned in the email to us that you were involved in a new plan for prescription drugs, I think a Sanders plan, on sort of trying to deal with some of these pricing issues or incentivizing pharmaceutical innovation that's more accessible. So the general topic of access to drugs, I'd love to hear your thoughts on.
Well, sure. I just want to, first of all, say I don't think I can claim to have been involved. You know, the people in the Sanders office, just like people in other congressional offices, reached out to me to get my opinions on what they were doing, and I provided them. And, you know, in a lot of our articles, I think, were helpful, but I don't think that I was necessarily involved in creating the bill. But that being said, you know, I do think it is an exciting, there are a couple of exciting ideas in the bill. On the Harvoni Sovaldi issue, you know, it's a really tough situation. You know, it does appear like this is a transformative drug, and a very effective drug, and could be very useful in you know, potentially curing a widespread infectious disease. You know, there isn't a lot of precedent in medicine for a medication that can cure a virus, you know, a chronic virus like hepatitis C, and you know, hepatitis C is such a difficult disease in the U.S. and particularly overseas in lower income settings. So I mean, I think that you have to think about the cost of the drug which is $100,000 for the 8-week course of the drug, not even for a year's treatment of it. In the context of that, you know, the people at Gilead would argue, and I think that they would argue correctly, that even priced at that number, the drug is cost effective because, you know, if you discount the fact that a lot of these people are going to need liver transplants or are going to, you know, die, you know, terrible liver failure deaths, the cirrhosis, you know, 20, 30 years down the road, you know, paying a little bit of money now will save a lot of money later. But it is also true that just because something is cost-effective doesn't mean that it's affordable. And the simple fact is that with Gilead pricing it at the level it priced it at, you know, it's driving Medicaid budgets and federal prison health budgets through the roof, just to completely unaffordable levels. And those organizations are being forced to cut other benefits and ration the drug in ways that aren't necessarily clinically meaningful. So, you know, some Medicaid programs are setting up, you know, restrictions on the drug where the drug won't be allowed, you know, you won't be allowed to get the drug if you're currently, you know, drinking alcohol or if you're, you know, using narcotics or other things that are commonly found in patients with hepatitis C. But there's just that's not based on any scientific evidence. It's just based on them trying to prioritize who's going to get the product now. You know, they're reserving it for people who are at end stages of their disease. But, you know, arguably, you know, maybe the drug would be better off given in patients who are at earlier stages when the disease is curable and you don't have to then deal with the sequelae of an advanced stage disease. So I think it's a really big problem. So, you know, what are the potential solutions to the problem? Well, you know, one of the things that you could do is you could try to take some of the handcuffs off of the purchasers in these circumstances. And, you know, the Medicare Medicaid programs, you know, they're not really allowed to, you know, negotiate the price of the product well because of various restrictions that they have on what they can or can't exclude from their formularies. And in the case of Medicare Part D, just because they're statutorily not allowed to negotiate the price of the drug, even though Medicare negotiates or sets the prices for every single healthcare service that it reimburses for, hospital visits, radiology exams, but they are statutorily not allowed to negotiate the price of drugs. So if you took away some of these restrictions that you have on purchasers, and you allowed purchasers to, you know, maybe if you gave certain purchasers antitrust waivers, like, you know, different states or health federal prison systems or stuff like that, you know, so that they could band together and negotiate better, then you'd get lower prices. In fact, you know, what you saw is when AbbVie introduced its product, prices came down a little bit to points that approximated prices in you know, other countries in Europe that have, you know, more centralized negotiating. So, you know, I think that's one way to try to address these high prices. I think it's interesting to think about, you know, what the price of the drug should be given how much Gilead invested in the drug, which is to say, you know, this drug arose from a small pharmaceutical enterprise that grew out of federally funded research at Emory. And then Gilead stepped in at the 11th hour and purchased the company for $11 billion. And then they made back that price in the first year. So I think it might also be interesting to think about how much drugs actually should cost based on how much investment went into the product. And that is actually one of the ideas in the Sanders bill by, you know, trying to make more transparent how much drug companies are spending on research and development in developing approved drugs to try to, you know, balance the cost of the drug with the cost of development better. And then, you know, there's also this idea of a patent buyout where, you know, the government would just pay up front for the expected costs of the product. But then, you know, given the fact that right now the cost of the product are based on this you know, tiered usage of the product and you know, direction of the product to certain individuals, but not other individuals. The government could, you know, set out to try to buy the product by buying out the patent ahead of time, and then, you know, give the drug to everybody, you know, at cost, which is, you know, $2 to $3 a pill, rather than doing the kind of this sort of prioritization dance that is currently happening. So that is a more extreme solution that I don't think is something that's going to happen anytime soon. But I think it is interesting to think about the application of that power that the government has under Section 1498 in the cases of drugs like Sovaldi and Harvoni that are these incredibly effective but also incredibly expensive products.
So just to underline the difficulty with regard to Sovaldi in particular, the English, or UK rather, National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, NICE, which is an agency that is generally extremely well regarded, and many of us would like to see some kind of analog in this country. They are a very, very tough hurdle to leap, and Sovaldi leapt the NICE hurdle, and NICE approved it. It was even in the UK, where because there's a more limited formulary, you will see some informal negotiation over pricing, one believes, but it's still even there, it's extremely expensive, such that its implementation had to be delayed while an additional sort of funding line was put in to pay for those additional costs. Let us finish, Aaron, with our new FDA chief. What do we know? This is someone who came to the agency from Duke, has been at the agency for a bit now. Do we know anything about the good doctor and his ability to fix some of the problems we've been talking about today?
Well, I don't know about that, but you know, he is a he's been in academic academics for you know, a long time. He is an expert in clinical trial design and implementation, and you know, I think that that's a really strong quality to have in somebody who's running the FDA. You know, he knows a lot about drugs, and he knows a lot about generating evidence around drugs by virtue of his expertise in clinical trials and his work with the DCRI down at Duke. And I, you know, as I said, I think, you know, unfortunately in the past, there in the 80s and 90s and early whatever in the 2000s, there have been FDA commissioners who are not experts in drugs and in evidence development, and that has been to the detriment of the FDA. So I think that the fact that he has that expertise and, you know, will hopefully mean that he will, you know, respect the evidence and will, you know, be a strong advocate on behalf of, you know, the FDA's essential role in making sure that there is evidence generated about healthcare products, and that evidence is evaluated in a, you know, expert and dispassionate way. And so hopefully that, you know, he will be able to, you know, use his clinical and research expertise to, you know, uphold the strong science-based foundations of the FDA. And I, you know, I think that's those are some of the more optimistic, you know, positive things about this particular nomination.
That was this week's The Week in Health Law. A special thank you to Aaron Kesselheim for joining us. You can find Aaron on Twitter at A Kesselheim. So AKESSELHEIM. Thank you so much for joining us, Aaron.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Anytime.
We post our show notes at twill.com. Also there, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank?
I'm at HealthPI on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.